and welcome to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Tuck, and Tom Edwards.
Today we'll be tracing the fashion journey of the trusty T-shirt with curator Jenna Rossi-Camus. She's one of the minds behind a new exhibition, T-shirt, Cult, Culture, Subversion at London's Fashion and Textile Museum.
We'll also be hearing from the journalist and author Alexis Akeowo about some of the real-life stories of bravery in the face of oppression that make up her book, A Moonless, Starless Sky.
And we'll be having a little more conversation, not less, that joke will make sense later in the programme, with the musician and soundtrack composer Tom Holkenberg. He's helped soundtrack blockbusters from Mad Max to Tomb Raider, in addition to making dance music hits under the moniker Junkie XL.
That's all to come, plus Monocle's Marcus Hippie will be looking forward to some of next week's news, and there'll be music too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
Always nice, isn't it, Andrew, to jump into Studio One for the Monocle Weekly, particularly in such a quiet, easy, procedural week around the place.
What's going on? It's gone a bit mad around here. It's an interesting time. We're in the midst of book production and we have some exciting changes that we'll be telling people about later in the year. We're gearing up already for a summer conference that's going to be in Zurich. Go to monocle.com, buy your ticket now. And there are some very interesting print products coming your way as well. It means some very kind of frazzled faces and some odd nervous twitches around the office.
And a fair bit of travelling. I think you're going to be jumping in a fast car almost straight out of the studio when the weekly's finished and jetting off somewhere else, aren't you?
If you're in Hong Kong, we have a subscribers event tomorrow, which I will be at for the day.
Count him down.
Yeah,
count down. Semaphore him into, into Hong Kong airport. Okay, Andrew, well, look, as you said, we're busy. Let's on with the show, shall we? We should welcome a man who always, though, despite the busyness, takes life at his own unique pace. It's Marcus Hippie.
Hello, guys. How are you doing?
We're doing very well, thank you. And I don't think I've done the news look ahead with you ever.
No, you haven't. It's the first time. No pressure, Andrew.
Okay.
And what have you got? Now, often we should say, if you're tasked with, say, filling one of our news programmes, and as a regular producer, mm-hmm. that's what you often do, often, is it fair to say, a Finnish bias to some of them? Is it right
to say that? So.
Now you're a British citizen, though, are all bets off? It's all changed.
Well, let's make our assumptions on that after this news roundup, shall we? So first story for this week is actually from today. It's an important day in Russia. The presidential election takes place over there. Quite a few candidates, if I list some of those. There is, obviously, Vladimir Putin, the current president, is running
Apparently
for
he's presidency
again.
Apparently he's fancied in some quarters to win again.
Exactly. He's got a fair chance, it seems. There is Pavel Grudinin, who is from the Russian Communist Party. There is Vladimir Zhirinovsky from the Liberal Democratic Party of Russia. We know him quite well in Finland because already in 1990s he was going on about how if he becomes the president, Russia should take over Finland. some other names from there. Grigory Yavlinsky is from the Yabloga party, and Ksenia Sobchak is a Russian TV personality and a socialite as well.
And she's genuinely quite interesting because people are suggesting that she's almost running in a slightly kind of mischievous way, but she's actually gained a fair bit of traction. I mean, the caveat to all of this is that can we declare Putin the winner?
We can obviously declare Putin a winner. But I think it's interesting, something we've been talking about on Monocle 24 as well, is that despite Vladimir Putin obviously winning this election again, it looks like he's a bit worried about how the youngest voters are going to be behaving in this election. It seems that Russia may be changing slightly, gradually.
And just tell me, very nice pronunciation. Did you have Russian lessons at school?
I have taken the basics of Russian. It's always this debate of what my CV said when I applied to work for Monocle. Some people claimed that I actually speak fluent Russian, which is not the case. That's actually one of the reasons probably why I can't leave Monocle, because I know that we have this tradition that when you leave, then Andrew goes to this locker and finds this old work application, a CV, and goes that through in front of everyone. Anyway, moving on to other stories.
No, I'm I'm just hearing from Her Majesty's Passport Agency. Apparently, if you've misdeclared Russian potential on your CV, you can be freshly re-exiled back to Finland again.
But you know, tomorrow this is one of my favorite news stories.
This is one
of my favorite news stories of the week. Yanis Varoufakis, the former Greek finance minister, is actually going to discuss the power of William Shakespeare's plays here in London, in Kingston, tomorrow at the Rose Theatre Kingston. It sounds quite random, but there is a surprising logic to this. So during the worst times of the Greek financial crisis, he was calling the crisis a Shakespearean tragedy, and he's also been comparing the world's leaders to Shylock and Macbeth. So he seems to know his Shakespeare pretty well.
And he's just a very bright man, actually. So we've had him here in the studio. I think he's been in this chair, still warm, for Mr. Varoufakis. But yeah, he's been in. We like him.
I think it's great.
We think he's interesting, anyway.
I think it's amazing that world leaders, when they leave politics, they start doing something that's a bit unconventional. This obviously is a great example of that. And I was kind of playing this game in my mind. I was thinking, who else would I like to, you know, go and talk about literature or plays? And I was thinking, you know, some current names. Rex Tillerson, for example, doesn't have much to do now. I'd like to see him talk about the best publications by J.K. Rowling, for example. Or, I don't know, Francois Hollande talking about the greatest moments of Jackie Collins. Yeah. I would definitely go and pay some money for that.
It's a new miniseries. And it's commissioned on the spot. That's very interesting. As you say, counterintuitive and yet strangely maybe apposite.
Think outside of the box, that's the point.
Well, and I guess you've been doing that with these news items. What's next?
Well, it's one of my happiest days on Tuesday because it's the International Day of Happiness declared as such by the United Nations. I was wondering how should one celebrate that?
A long-haul flight, Andrew, perhaps?
Well, hold on, because I think I've seen who the winner is.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. I believe that your home nation has been named as one of the happiest places in the world to live.
It's number one now. I think it's quite surprising. I don't think Finland has ever actually won that spot before, and I don't know. I don't live there anymore. I'm kind of like, is there a connection between me not being there anymore and like that country being happy? And also, you know, if Finland is that happy, then according to some logic, I should be kind of more miserable now living in the UK than I was before, which I don't feel. I don't know.
Well, no, but now you're truly British, a full citizen. Maybe that sort of recalibrates the balance.
Itself. Yeah. I think Finns
are very nice and lots of things we like about Finns.
But what don't you like?
But I was going to say, happiness is not the first word that comes to mind.
They're not the most outwardly, arrestingly happy people, are they?
I think it's interesting because I think Finnish people are happy in their own way. There's a certain amount of self-mockery over there. I know that there's been a lot of discussions now after this recent announcement saying that surely can't be true and, you know, they all are just complaining about random facts and random things over there. But in the end, life's quite easy and quite nice over there. So I guess if you want, how would I phrase this politely, if you want an easy life with, I don't know, free education, childcare and all that, that's for you.
And daily sauna.
Absolutely.
And no sunshine in the winter. And
or much
horrible cold and rain in the summer. Yeah.
I actually took the producer of this program to a Finnish sauna.
And at what point did you steal that Bulgarian guy's swimming trunks?
That's a whole another story.
Okay. Shall we move on?
Let's have one more news story, something a bit more serious now. So on Thursday, March the 22nd, there's a high-level conference in Paris on how to finance the Paris climate goals. It's an example of, you know, how nations were very eager to contribute to this deal, this treaty, and, you know, make a lot of promises. But then at the same time, you get a lot of responsibilities with that, and that may be expensive. So we are seeing this moment now that countries would really need to act on that and actually figure out what they're going to be doing and how they're going to be doing that and where the money is going to be coming from. So I think this is an important moment of actually realization how we are going to be proceeding in this issue.
I like the fact, you see, this is also plays into the Finns jolly. Everyone always ends with a funny story, but not you. You've gone for like...
Climate change. Straight in there.
Yeah, starts always finish with a downer. I guess that's a great Finnish principle.
I guess it works in ski jumping, right?
Absolutely.
Marcus, thank you so much for joining us. We're going to be discussing the history of the humble T-shirt with Jenna Rossi Camus next. Your favourite tee might seem a fairly unremarkable feature of your wardrobe, but have you ever considered that everyone else has a trusty favourite too?
That's a lot of T-shirts, a lot of variety, and a lot of goodwill towards one of the seemingly most simple go-to staples of clothing.
You might even call it a cultural phenomenon, Andrew. And London's Fashion and Textile Museum are thinking the same thing with their most recent exhibition, T-shirt, Cult, Culture, Subversion. The showcase traces the T-shirt's journey from its early incarnation as men's underclothes to a symbol of rebellion through punk and politics to it also becoming a luxury fashion item.
Jenna Rossi Camus is one of the event's curators and she joins us now. Welcome to the Monocle Weekly, Jenna. Now, first of all, you should tell us what exactly is exciting about the T-shirt for you and why did you want to curate the show?
Right, so many things are exciting about the T-shirt, which is why our exhibition has 12 themes and almost 200 T-shirts. By titling it Cult, Culture, Subversion, it's not just to be sensational, but those are really things that are at the heart of the way that T-shirts have been made, worn, understood. And while they get a lot of attention anyway because of other things that are going on in the world, and we wanted to remove them from the context and put them all in a room, see what happens when they talk to each other, so to speak.
But are you looking at the political charge that runs across the chests of many of these T-shirts? Is it the slogan, the emblem, the campaign promise that's made on a T-shirt that excites you here?
Yeah, visual and textual messages are at the core of what we're looking at the T-shirt. Of course, we acknowledge the white T-shirt. It's coming from underwear, and there has already been quite a lot said about the T-shirt in pop, in its sexuality. And we look at all of those things, but we are primarily seeing it as a vehicle of communication, and whether that be word or image or the both.
Well, if we talk about as that sort of medium, that platform, was there, I guess you said you want to sort of put it in a different context, but it's tempting to look at the golden age, I suppose, of T-shirts. Mm. And certainly in terms of that simple messaging, I tend to think of maybe the 1980s, and whether it's, you know, Frankie Says Rats or whatever it might be, that seemed to be the zenith or the nadir, depending on how you look at it. Is that a fair point? Was that sort of when it reached its maximum kind of cultural...
Well, I think what's happening is that we're seeing, with all fashion and certainly history, it's cyclical to a degree. So even though, we put the moment of Catherine Hamnett meeting Margaret Thatcher in 1985 up, and it's the poster image. There was no doubt about that having to be not necessarily a zenith, but a center point. The exhibition concept grew out of a plan to exhibit the collection of Vivienne Westwood and Westwood and McLaren T-shirts that are collected by one person. And when we examine those, we thought, well, there's actually so much here, and it's not only about commemorating punk and the late 1970s and what happened in the aftermath, but even Westwood and McLaren acknowledged that those T-shirts were coming out of things that they had already seen in the 60s. So nothing just it occurs in a vacuum. Rather organically, the exhibition started to map the overlaps, so even though we are thematic and we have a section dedicated to music and a section dedicated to fashion and to campaign T-shirts, as you say, what we have done is embedded a clue to some of the other themes in each theme.
We're talking about the golden age of T-shirts, and I wonder if what's interesting about that time is if you wanted to shout something and say something about yourself, there weren't that many ways of doing it. So the T-shirt was a 140 character kind of space on your chest where you could say something offensive, funny, engaging about your politics or your music. Because there weren't that many other places to do it. Now there's so many places that you can holler, shout, declare your views. Has that diminished the role of the Chester's campaign promise?
Hopefully, I think it might enlarge it, because now if you are wearing a T-shirt and with the power of social media and your ability to disseminate that image much further, it isn't only about those people you encounter in real life or the chance that you might be photographed and that photograph might end up in the larger public sphere. Certainly this was something that Catherine Hamnett said herself, right? These are the messages that we need to be reminded of. We need to see them walking down the street. We need to see them from 200 meters away. But I think that possibly we could say that the T-shirt saturation point of there being such a production, there being so many of these messages, it can diminish the power. But at the same time, the overlap of the saturation of kitsch and then the authentic messages, if they have a greater resonance and a greater ability to be shared by the individual person, that's really their power.
Because as someone who was at university, most of the people around me were not even born, I'm afraid to say. But back in the 80s, every single person, they had a jacket with a badge that said something about politics or anti-nuclear. They had a T-shirt with a campaign slogan. And I do notice that when I'm on the street, you,
you see that less and less. And the other thing that kind of worries me about the T-shirt for your curation and going forwards is that many high street fashion companies saw those slogans and adopted them in a very commercial way, adapting them to, you know, be funny, to almost kind of spoof the thing that had gone before. Again, does that interest you, that the way that's been picked up by the high street?
Absolutely. I mean, personally, it was one of the motivating factors for me to take the project on board. About a year ago, maybe a little bit more, I noticed the rise in the amount of T-shirts saying authentic, feminist, that were being sold by high street stores. And my initial reaction was to be quite angry and quite cynical about it, but also to reflect on when I was a teenager and the kind of messages that I wanted to be wearing, which were inherited from the 1960s. And possibly people who were older than me might have been cynical about why is this 12-year-old wearing a peace symbol T-shirt in the late 1980s. So working on the project allowed me to say, while I can still be highly critical of the commercialization of these messages, certainly the people who are consuming these things, it's really up to them whether buying a feminist T-shirt in the high street is a doorway to start to engage with those ideas on a deeper level. Hopefully it doesn't just end up in landfill, which is another one of, you know, the paradoxes about the T-shirt. What we see with the T-shirt is that people do hold on to them. People do tend to keep them, even though they are sometimes the cheapest, most disposable, almost prey to changing opinion of all our garments.
And what about the sort of post-modern T-shirt, the luxury item? You know, you see the sort of running T-shirt that's $200 or $300 US dollars, not any branding in sight, and that's kind of the point. Is that the end piece of the exhibition, or does that open the next chapter?
I think it opens the chapter, and in our, we have a section that is, you know, expressly the fashion T-shirt. But again, it encapsulates crossovers with the fashion, with artists and fashion, with politics and fashion, and certainly with music, and obviously with self-ironizing and the knockoff. So all those things are in our exhibition, walking on one catwalk and really raising, you know, with the question of, right, so you have the luxury fashion item. A story that we've been telling quite a bit is that we decided to buy a Gucci logo T-shirt, you know, from Gucci at its actual price to be part of the exhibition. It had a slightly distressed version of the logo in its printing, but we also noticed that it had a small section of undone threads around the neck. And we thought certainly we'd gotten a damaged one. And it turns out that no, that tiny imperfection was part of its design. So I think the joke was on us, really. But at the same time, I think it opens up a conversation around who is the joke on, and those imperfections become so much part of a reaching for authenticity that they've actually been programmed into the luxury items.
And what about, it's interesting that point about authenticity, because one of the narratives I often hear is, particularly if you see people walking around Camden wearing a Ramones t-shirt or something, and then you get these grizzled old veterans saying, oh, I bet they couldn't even name all the band members and this kind of thing.
Yeah.
Is the wearing authentic, whether or not the message is your message? Do you see what I mean? Or, or second or third hand ownership? Does it mean the message is different?
I think it's different. I think it's individualized. And certainly there's a lot of thoughtlessness in the world in what we wear and why. Certainly Ramones t-shirts, they can filter around the globe. They end up in secondhand clothes. They can be worn by people who have never seen a Ramones logo or heard of them, just as a completely utilitarian garment. But also, just like with feminism, sometimes what's to say that that person might surprise you for actually knowing more than you hold them, you know, accountable for at first glance.
And just tell me, we haven't talked too much about the world of music, but I guess the overlay between rock and the rock t-shirt and the protest t-shirt and the politics, there's a sweet spot in the middle where all of those things are coming together. Is the world of music still a good generator of a fun t-shirt?
I think it is. And I think especially as music is, you know, entirely online and we're quite remote from album cover art, then the t-shirt is the purveyor of that message. And I think what we also are doing in the exhibition is looking at the music graphics as examples of visual culture. Like, again, the Ramones logo, I hadn't really thought about it, but I've been looking at it in my whole life, and that it's based on the, you know, seal of the President of the United States. And I never really thought about a political connection between that. I'd always taken it for granted. So the music t-shirt does continue to be something tribal. And I guess now, even more than ever, be cross-generational, because, like, as you say, I mean, there's a shop I pass all the time, they make Nirvana t-shirts for babies. So, you know, I'm obviously there's demographic targeted marketing there.
You have 200 T-shirts in the exhibition. Can you give us one or two stand-up pieces and describe some of the art or the sloganery that kind of goes with them?
What we haven't really touched on so far is that we have a section dedicated to art and the T-shirt, and T-shirts that have been made by artists, prime among them being Jeremy Deller. And I think quite brilliantly and unbeknownst to us, that he released a series of T-shirts in October, and they were anti-Brexit shirts, and they were also parodies of different types of T-shirts. So a psychedelic smiley face, the parody of Comme des Garçons that was already a fashion parody. So you have this doubling and tripling of a joke. Also, he did a parody of experimental Jet Sets Beatles T-shirt. So we put them in because all our themes were already there, and it was almost like his conversation with the T-shirt was intersecting with ours. So that was a pretty exciting moment for us. And I think something else that maybe comes out as a standout now, and that's just happened in the past 2 weeks, is that we have a T-shirt by an independent fashion label called Rodding Dean Bazaar in our show. And it's extremely oversized, and it says we do big sizes 1, 3, 4, 5, 6X. My co-curator David Sinclair, when he saw this T-shirt premiered in January of this year, when essentially the exhibition was already finished, and we decided that we needed to add it and we needed to acknowledge this in our last word section, which was where we were putting the things that were, we really felt were T-shirts doing their work and going beyond. And we thought for fashion to have this thing about sizeism was really important. But ironically and rather shockingly, Vivienne Westwood copied the T-shirt and without permission. So it's been something that's been playing out on Instagram. So Andreas Quantelow for Vivienne Westwood, they sent the exact T-shirt down the catwalk, also with the handwriting of another designer, Louise Gray. It's been appropriated. They've mixed it up with collage imagery, but they didn't ask permission, and they've apologized after the fact. And now it's kind of cracked open that discussion again about copying, about appropriation, I think also about the proportion between who you are and when you can and can't do that sort of thing.
Well, the highest form of flattery, they say,
it's always easier
to say that from without. Yeah. We have to just ask you, Jenna, your current garment,
is that a
T-shirt? If so, what does that depict? Obviously, we're in a radio medium,
we're in radio.
So it's tricky.
I figured this T-shirt was safe for radio. I am wearing the Westwood and McLaren 2 Cowboys T-shirt. It's a fake, first of all. It is purchased by somebody who claims to have copies of the original screens, and I purposely bought a fake just to test it as a, what does it mean to people? Do they recognise what it is anyway? It's also a version with the sleeves and the neck cut out. So it started life as a T-shirt. It's been cut down. So it was a T-shaped garment. It is now a vest, but it clearly bears the imprint of having once been intact.
I like it. It's like a performance piece.
And before we wrap, Tom, what was your best slogan T-shirt that you used to wear?
Oh, let me think. I don't know.
There's some good ones, I bet.
It's probably some sort of dubious Bay Area punk rock T-shirt with a probably, frankly, unpronounceable and best left that way slogan on it.
Okay.
Is this a prompt to ask?
No, not at all. Many years ago, I used to really like, we were still around, Anthony and Alison, good designers, and they made, again, a long, long time ago, they made a lot of T-shirts with slightly confusing, arty kind of statements on, or very simple instructions. Now it's time to dance or something. And I used to have a penchant for them, but that was in a former age.
Andrew Tutt breaking that one out on the dance floor.
I was there. I was given a Hamnet T-shirt, maybe like years and years and years ago. It was just after she'd done the first slogan, she did some additional ones, and it's one of those bizarre things that I thought, oh, that's cool, but I've never worn it, and I've managed to keep it in my wardrobe for 20 plus years, whatever. So there you go.
Collector's piece.
Tomorrow, new outfit.
Yeah, absolutely.
Or exhibition part two or something. It could be. Another wing to the exhibit. Jenna, it's absolutely amazing to talk with you about it. It's absolutely compelling. And our listeners can see for themselves. It's on now. It runs through to the end of May. And then it goes on the road.
And then we're off to the Civic in Barnsley.
Fantastic. Yeah. Thank you, Jenna. And T-shirt, Cult Culture Subversion, is at London's Fashion and Textile Museum through to the 6th of May and then touring. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly.
Now, Andrew, a little later in the programme, we'll be talking to film soundtrack composer Tom Holkenberg, but he's had more than one go at hitting the musical big time. He's also the dance music producer known as Junkie XL, or JXL, to his parents. So we're hoping to go back a few years now. Very evocative for me, this one is. Play a tune that he helped create with a generous helping from one Elvis Aaron Presley, who I have actually heard of as well. This is Junkie XL with A Little Less Conversation.
From 2002, the sound of Elvis Presley and Junkie XL there, the latter also known as Tom Holkenborg. And we're going to be talking to him at the end of the show. You're listening to The Bonnacle Weekly.
A Moonless Starless Sky by New Yorker staff writer Alexis Okeoo has won praise for its brave storytelling and emotionally diverse accounts of everyday individuals fighting oppression. It tells the true stories of those making stands against warlords and fundamentalists across nations like Somalia, Uganda, Nigeria and Mauritania.
Recently, Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco caught up with Alexis for a brief chat about her work and what inspired her to write the book.
When I lived in Uganda, it was my first extended time being in Africa. After I graduated from college, I knew I wanted to work in journalism, but I didn't want to go to New York and sort of try to find a job, and there weren't that many jobs anyway. And I had happened to get an internship at the state-run newspaper in Uganda through an alumni program at my alma mater. And I went there and I was named a junior reporter and I shadowed senior reporters at the newspaper and I got to do all kinds of stories, environmental, political, human rights stories. I got to travel around the country and it was an incredible experience just learning the ropes of journalism and being on the continent and learning this new place.
When you were there, were you already thinking perhaps about the book, in a way?
No, not at all. I mean, I was very green. I was just learning how to really report and write a story. It wasn't until some years later, when I was based in Nigeria, that the idea for the book began to form.
And, you know, we have to mention the book is all about, you know, normal citizens in Africa. I mean, specifically in four countries that are fighting extremism, fundamentalism. And it's nice because, you know, it's the story of kind of, you know, the average citizen, but they're doing wonderful things as well. So is that your idea as well, to kind of personalize more, you know, the countries you're talking about, those specific stories as well?
Exactly. I mean, the only reason I say Africa in the title is because I literally am talking about four countries across the continent. But once you start the book, you see that I do talk about each country specifically, the historical and cultural context in each place, in order to tell the story of the people in each of these countries. And although some similarities, I'm sure, will arise and readers will notice themes that connect these four places, they're all incredibly different. And I wanted to make sure to show how different each of these places are. But what unites them are how, as you say, ordinary people in each place begin to stand up for what they believe in against fundamentalism.
If you don't mind perhaps sharing some of those stories, and they're basing certain characters or a couple.
Right.
So it's basically one in Uganda, Mauritania, Nigeria, and Somalia.
Yeah.
Would you mind telling us, for example, Uganda, which that's where you had your internship. So
right.
What's the story there?
Well, the story in Uganda is that for over two decades, the Christian fundamentalist rebel group, the Lord's Resistance Army, led by Joseph Kony, waged a rebellion in the north of that country, terrorizing the population, mutilating, killing civilians, and kidnapping tens of thousands of children. Eventually, some of those children who were kidnapped and forced to be soldiers and to kill and commit atrocities began to escape later as adults. And I write about one couple who were both kidnapped as children. They were forced to be together in captivity to have children. And then they each escaped with their children and decided to reunite once they were back in their home communities, much to the sort of shock and surprise of people they knew and their former neighbors, who couldn't believe that Eunice, the woman in the couple, would decide to reunite with Bosco, the boy she had been forced to be with in captivity and was initially raped by him. You know, Eunice told me that they formed a bond while in the bush, and they had children together, and a love formed between them. And so by this couple deciding to reunite after escaping, it was their way of rejecting what the LRA tried to do to them, which was tear them away from any sense of identity or love or family. They decided to forge that themselves, despite what the LRA had forced them to do, like kill and commit atrocities, and in spite the way they had tried to erase their identities. And so by choosing to love each other and choosing to form to be a family while free, it was their acts of resistance in a way against the fundamentalism the LRA had tried to impose upon them.
Alexis, the type of job you do, not only with the book, because before I believe you're a staff writer for The New Yorker,
right.
you've always been covering kind of similar stories mm-hmm. for all sorts of publications. Mm-hmm. It must be quite emotional as well when you get so involved with the stories of those people. I mean, when you read the book, it's like, how does this affect you personally?
Yeah, I mean, it's true. You know, as much as I think as a reporter, you want to stay impartial and objective, but with some distance, especially when you're writing a book and spending so much time with your subjects, it's impossible not to get involved and not to feel for them. You know, when I was in Somalia writing about teenage girls who, despite the fact that extremists in that country say that women should stay inside and shouldn't play sports, these girls go out anyway and still play basketball, even though they're threatened with death at gunpoint and over the phone. And I grew attached to the girl I wrote about, Aisha, who, you know, was 17 years old, playing basketball, incredibly brave. You know, she didn't think of herself as an activist or a hero. She just wanted to live her life. But I still felt worried about her. You know, I thought she's going to the basketball court and she's already been accosted at gunpoint like several times. You know, I don't want anything to happen to her. I heard, you know, obviously, like most people, I heard about the huge terrorist attacks in Somalia last fall where hundreds of people were killed. And immediately I wondered about her and I reached out to try to make sure she was okay. You know, your subjects become part of your lives after spending so much time with them, and you can't really just cut them off. Yeah. You know, you have to, you can't help but keep them in your thoughts.
And also talking more as about the personal level, I mean, you mentioned in the book your parents are Nigerian, right?
Yeah.
So how was your experiences, you know, when you went to Nigeria? Did they actually saw you as an American, or mm-hmm. did you feel any connection? Because, you know, I understand this feeling. So
right.
how did it came about when you were there?
Right. Well, it was interesting because unlike elsewhere in Africa where I felt like, you know, in Ugandans saw me as American as opposed to sort of African. When I went to Nigeria, people definitely saw me as Nigerian. And that was actually a really welcome experience. There was so much about Nigeria that felt familiar because of my family heritage. And then to be sort of welcomed in as you know, one of their own was also pretty nice. I mean, you know, there was also this kind of feeling of like, you're Nigerian, but, you know, you also are American. So we have to make fun of you for that a little bit, too. But there was a sense of welcomeness that made me eventually come to think of the place as home, as another home.
Alexis Akeowo there, speaking to Fernando Augusto Pacheco. And A Moonless, Starless Sky, Ordinary Women and Men Fighting Extremism in Africa is available now. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly. Most of us would be lucky to have one career in the music industry, but some of us managed to create a few. And soundtrack composer Tom Holkenborg is one of those very talented people.
The Dutch musician is the sound behind the upcoming Tomb Raider reboot and has composed works for a slew of other superhero blockbusters recently, including Mad Max Fury Road, Deadpool, and the recent Superman and Justice League films. Not only that, but you may know his remixing skills from Elvis's A Little Less Conversation, which was a huge hit, of course, under Tom's Junkie XL moniker.
We're going to be talking to Tom in a moment, but first let's hear a clip of his work. This is the new Tomb Raider reboot heading to screens now.
Lara, your father's gone. You can pick up where he left off.
I see so much of him in you.
Brilliant.
Hello, Sprout. If you're listening to this, then I must be dead. I found something. A tomb called the Mother of Death. If Trinity succeeds, our world is in danger. Promise me you will stop them.
I promise.
I think I know where my dad went.
That's right in the middle of the Devil's Sea.
It'll be an adventure.
Death is not an adventure.
And Tom Holkenborg joins us now. Welcome to the Monocle Weekly, Tom.
Now, before we dive into your latest work, just looking at your career, you're one dedicated man to working hard. The list of credits for film, for music, for games is extraordinary. How do you manage to produce so much work? Do you have a studio in Los Angeles, or are you still based partly in the Netherlands?
I mean, I have a studio in Los Angeles since 2002, so it's 16 years now. And yes, I have to say, like, when I look at my list of stuff that I've been working on, you know, for the last 30 years or so, it's scary, I have to say. But nonetheless, it's just the way that I am. I have this amazing output. I make anywhere between 7 to 9 hours of music every year. I've always done that. And it was great to work on all these different fields. And now, obviously, it's film. And it's important to have like a somewhat decent amount of output because you have to do, you know, quite some things again and just look at what you've written, and just depending on the feedback of the director, you know, have to take a different approach or to see how it can work better. So I would say it's great to have a good amount of output and a diversity as well on things that you work on. Yeah, like I said, it's just the nature of the beast. It's always been there, and hopefully we'll stay for a while here.
Now, I think most of us probably have perhaps an old-fashioned view of how a soundtrack gets done. I imagine, you know, you're given the final film and you sit there with your piano and a pencil in your mouth and you finally come up with a bit of a tune to go with it. But how involved are you early on, seeing rushes, being brought into the process of making the film, being fed some inspirations from the director, etc., to know what to do and when to do it?
Well, there's a couple of scenarios how this works out. And the two major ones are, one, you work with this director for the very first time and you work with this studio for the first time. And second, you have worked with this director before multiple times and also with the same studio multiple times. So let's go back to option number one, which is you're working for the first time with this studio and director. So you might have read the script and then you just get together with the director. And at that point, it's really trying to feel each other out and see if you have a connection. For instance, I recently met Robert Rodriguez and we had this connection about food. We just love to cook. So all these things are very important. And then basically the director needs to decide after an hour, hour and a half, whether, you know, you are the guy for his film. And it depends on that connection that you have, but also the music ideas that you have, and obviously the body of work that you have done. When the decision is being made, then you actually see the film and in its very first draft, and then you start writing themes or pieces of music that you feel fit the film. And I usually send it out and say to the director, do you recognize your film in this? And then if yes, we're just going to continue on a scene level. And if no, you would take another stab at it until the director feels that he's hearing his film in it. Now, in the second scenario, when you have worked with the director before, you're obviously going to be way earlier involved in the process, if not alone, just talking about it. Usually, working with a director is a very intense relationship. You talk a lot with each other. You might bicker a lot what the solution needs to be. Nevertheless, you always, in my scenario, you always come out as friends on the other end. So it means that you do get together on social occasions and you just talk about what you're both working on, which usually means that whatever the director is going to talk about, that's going to be also your project to work on. So in that scenario, I'm sometimes aware 3 years before the movie comes out what is going to happen. And in that scenario, the director potentially wants you to start earlier, so by the time he starts editing the film, he already has some music to work with that's uniquely made for the film. So those are the two main scenarios that I've come across and how this works out.
And Tom, just talking about collaboration and working with people maybe several times over, you know, again, Andrew's already talked about your sort of long list of credits, but what's it like if you're working with somebody who's kind of royalty, certainly in terms of movie soundtracking, someone like a Hans Zimmer, for example? Do you have to change up your approach, or do you change the way you work if you're collaborating or being influenced by somebody like that, who I guess is kind of, well, yeah, I mean, Hollywood royalty, really. What's that like when you sort of cross paths with somebody or some of these other great directors, you know, Chris Nolan's, all these famous people? I mean, what's that like? Do you change your approach, or do you always stick to the same principles?
Well, I would say by default, the film industry is a collaborative process where we're all sailors on a ship, and the director is the captain of the ship. And that's the basic setup that works for every film. Obviously, a director will not say to you, I want you to write a piece of music exactly like this and this and this. That's all up to you. You know, you can come up with a concept for a score, and then the director will start massaging that until, you know, he gets what he wants. The thing with Hans is that I've met him multiple times, and we just really started developing a relationship. So yes, he's a Hollywood royalty, but then when you're in one room, you know, you're talking about a Dutch guy and a German guy in one room filled with synthesizers, and then it's just like noodling with synthesizers and playing around and kicking back ideas. And also that is a completely collaborative process, and something that I really like. I didn't know I would like it this much. I've played in bands when I was really young, and then eventually I wanted to take more control and have more say into what the music end result needed to be. So that resulted in me working alone as a producer and then collaborate with artists to do these songs from early 90s to even up to 2015. But it's not until I really broke into the film industry, I really realized how much I love the collaborative aspect and everything that comes with it. Managing your own time, managing expectations of the studio and the director. And I can now say, after pretty much done all corners of the music industry, that I really feel like a fish in the water when I'm a film composer, and it feels just really natural.
And tell me, we've just had the Oscars season. When you get commissioned to do a score, do they say to you, it wouldn't be bad if we won the Oscar for this, or are you not under that kind of commercial pressure?
I would say, you know, the Oscars are their completely own world, you know, if you will. It's a world that has a lot to do with politics and whatever goes on in society, and you always see that reflected in the Oscars, like whatever theme it is that year or a couple of years. Also, having said that, besides, you know, you need to be working on a certain type of film to be even considered in the music category for the Oscars. Same goes for director. And I have been lucky to work with a bunch of really interesting directors at this point that do have that notch from the Academy. So who knows what happens in the future. But honestly, for me and for my career that I have at this point, it doesn't really have that much impact. The blockbuster film category, usually, that I do the scores for, it's completely its own world and things that are required for that. I mean, I would say it's much harder to actually complete a blockbuster film score from beginning to end than it is, you know, your typical 25 to 35 minutes of serious music that needs to go underneath a serious drama that usually is what the Oscars nominate. So I wish there was a separate category for that. It takes way longer to do a score for a movie like that, and it's more intense. Nevertheless, it would be really great, obviously, to be in the position in the future to win an Oscar.
But just tell me, success for you and for a director, are they the same thing or are they different? Because I wonder if you want people to come out of the cinema saying, wow, that soundtrack was extraordinary, I must go and download the music. And the director thinks, I want it to be a character almost, you know, a side player in the film. And I hope that people aren't too focused on the soundtrack when they come out.
Yeah, there's definitely a different school of thought at this point in time than there was many years ago. I mean, it just goes up and down in waves in history. We're now definitely riding a wave where a lot of directors do not want a score with big, memorable themes like Star Wars or Indiana Jones. They simply don't want it. And it happens a lot with the movies that I work on, that even bringing in just one tone, the director is looking at me, it's like, that's too much. Like, let's take it out. Or they want some relentless action music without really music, actually, and just like rhythms and just sound design sounds. So that's definitely what's very fashionable at this point, not because the composer wants to do that just on its own. But it's really a wish from many of these young directors that want to have music that doesn't really say too much what the audience is supposed to be feeling. Like if you watch the opening of Indiana Jones, and those two movies are iconic, I think, and Star Wars, because of the incredible skill that John Williams has as a composer. But nonetheless, directors now are not looking for that anymore. That was then, and it fits those movies perfectly. And then there's other directors that don't necessarily want the memorable theme, but they do want the music to be so bold that it becomes this extra character in the film. And in recent years, for me at least, that has been Mad Max and Deadpool, where the director was constantly saying, you know, bring it up a notch, go over the top here, just go crazy, but don't go memorable theme, just go for noise and rhythms and things like that. So I find that very inspiring, because so many different areas of making music are inspiring. And it's great to see that a lot of the soundtracks that I have been doing are actually now living a life outside of film. Movies like 300 Rise of an Empire was a really well-sold CD, Mad Max 2 and Deadpool also, where people just keep playing the music because they really like it, or they're working out to it, or they like to drive fast with it, or whatever the reason might be. And those are really cool things. I got this really nice email from J.J. Abrams a while back where, you know, he was saying, I play your Black Mass music all the time when I'm writing. And, you know, those are amazing compliments to get, obviously. And that's when you see that music can live a life outside of a film completely, you know, depending, obviously, on what the character is. I've also done film scores where the music was so minimalistic that I decided, you know, it doesn't even make sense to release this, because outside of the film, it wouldn't really have a life. And so you have to look at that with every film score, what's the case.
And I just wonder, Tom, if we go back sort of to the beginnings of your story, if you like it, in music, as a musician, first and foremost, did you ever imagine that your initial sort of dabblings and forays would take you down the route that you've gone to? Is there ever a sense of kind of returning to your origins? Or, I mean, you talk so eloquently about the joy in whatever the project is you're working on. Does it feel the same as when you were starting out? I just wonder what that kind of evolution of your experience is as you've become, you know, more successful, as you've relocated to California and so on.
Well, I have to say that since I was very young, I was drawn to music with a strong filmic character to it, but then music that came from the popular music world at the time. So I was 7 years old when I got Dark Side of the Moon as a present from my older nephew, 1974, I think. And that album was like a concept album that really took you by the hands and just let you through, you know, the fantasy and weirdness that Pink Floyd had at the time to make music. And from that point on, all these type of albums were really drawing me in. War of the Worlds, Jeff Lynne, albums from Yellow, electronic duo from Switzerland, the Blade Runner soundtrack, Frankie Goes to Hollywood, all these conceptual albums, that's what I loved. And when I started releasing albums myself from somewhere in the 80s until 2014-15, I always wanted to create that journey, you know, that almost like cinematic journey through music. And it was not until 96, 97, I think, when I saw a movie that used a track of mine, not originally composed for the film, but actually licensed from an existing album. And that's when I saw what my music was actually doing to picture. And that's when I started taking baby steps towards, hey, maybe I want to be a film composer. And then in 2002, after my Elvis worldwide number one hit, A Little Less Conversation. That's when I decided, you know what, I want to go to LA and become a full-time film composer, to the horror of my managers and agents that were hoping to bank in on the success of the Elvis remix. But, you know, that's when I decided, you know what, let's throw all that away, take the back seat in the bus and just start from scratch and just see if I can become a film composer. And those were 10 really long years, and it was a lot of struggle, but eventually it paid off. And like I said earlier on, I'm really happy it did, because I really feel like a fish in the water with what I'm doing now.
Thank you, Tom. And if you want to hear more of Tom Holkenborg's work, we recommend you head to the nearest cinema wherever you are. Tomb Raider might well be on the screens right there, right now. You're with the Monocle Weekly.
And that's it, Tom. I like Tom Holkenborg. Tom.
It is a Tom club today, yes, if such a thing exists. Very interesting. I like someone who's enjoys a great success and then says, hey, do you know what? I've got another crazy ambition and I'm willing to travel halfway around the world and wait 10 years to make that one happen as well. Amazing. I felt quite inspired talking to Tom.
And how sweet that somebody who's called Junkie XL on the quiet is kind of really concerned about education. Yeah. And the fact that his mother kind of helped kind of kids who didn't have access to, you know, music lessons because of their social circumstances. So a very, very show.
A fantastic story. Thank you to Tom Holkenborg. Shall we thank the rest of the crew who've made it happen?
I'm going to help you. First of all, let's thank today's producer. That was Tom Hall.
And let's thank Christy Evans behind the glass. Thanks also go to Holly Fisher and George McDonough. The Monocle Weekly's back again at the same time next week. But for now, from me, Tom Edwards.
And me, Andrew Tuck.
It's goodbye. Thanks for listening.